Good morning. This is the
Shela.
This is the last Shabbat of April 2013, and it's the morning Bible study at Narkeese. My name is Randall Booth, and we're going to look at some texts today, and we're going to pray that God can use them to give us some maturity. I wish I could be more positive, because I will have to say that the topic today is a difficult one for me. And I'm not quite sure. I know I don't have the final answer. But we're going to look at it anyway, because I have to write on it this week. I've got an assignment for a dictionary on the Septuagint. And it's about time that I put ink to paper and commit myself. But I don't want to commit myself. But I have to. But I don't want to. But I have to anyway. And this tension going back and forth may come up this morning as we look at some texts. And now you can already guess what the text is. Yes, Jeff?
I see people and angels, possibly some Genesis 6.
Possibly some Genesis 6. Very good. Okay. Possibly, yes. But we're going to jump into the middle. Well, no, we can start with that. Can someone hand me... I'm going to grab an English Bible and read you Genesis 6. Then I'm going to read you Numbers 11:33. Then I'm going to read you another book. Okay, Genesis 6. No, I'm going to go all the way back to Genesis 5. When God created mankind, he made them in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them, and he named them... 5:1. And he named them mankind when they were created. When Adam lived 130 years, he had a son in his likeness, in his own image, and he named him Shet. After Shet was born, Adam lived 800 years, had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Adam lived a total of 930 years, then he died. We're skipping the whole rest, and we're jumping now to chapter 6. When human beings began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years." The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward. When the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them, they were the heroes of old, men of renown. Okay. You've all read that. I remember probably the first time I read that, I had become a believer. Reading the Bible through the first time, you get to a passage like that, and wow, where did that come from? What in the world is it talking about? Okay. Let's jump over to Numbers. It says the Nephilim were on the earth in those days. Okay, good for them. Now, Numbers 11. Was it 13 or 33? No, 13. Wait, what? I've got my reference in my head wrong. Yes, Numbers 13. I'm sorry, it's not 11, it's 13. 33. The people have spied out the land. I'm going to read from verse 32. They said, the land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them. That's strange. It says here the descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. Well, anyway, so.
Are you going to say what Anak is?
What Anak is? Just a person, right? No, it's just somebody's name. But Anak is also Hebrew for very, very big, giant. And but here it's also a personal name, but also I think is being used for giant. And the description is interesting. It says we were like grasshoppers in their size, in their eyes. Now if the spies, Joshua and others, were like grasshoppers in their eyes, I'm going to ask you a question. How big were these giants?
I don't know, but maybe they ate those grapes.
Maybe they ate those big grapes? Yeah. Yes, there were big grapes, and maybe they ate the big grapes. Now, I've always read that poetically. We were like grasshoppers, to be hyperbole and exaggeration. But sometimes people read things in the Bible very literally. So if you literally said we were like grasshoppers and you compare a grasshopper to a person, then how much bigger is a person than a grasshopper? And so much bigger are the Nephilim and from people. And so how big are the Nephilim? They would be very big. They would, no, they're not as big as that.
As big as what?
Empire State Building?
Yeah, I was going to say to a person.
But let me read now. Let me jump in midstream to the way people were thinking at the end of the Second Temple period. We have a book called Enoch, and it's canonical in the Ethiopic Church. And in the book of Enoch, they didn't let this just stand. We read that little paragraph in Genesis, and it has lots of questions. When we look at it, we're going to see that almost every verse of those four verses is filled with question marks. And perhaps the author intended all those question marks to be there. I'm just not sure. One thing that is for sure, he certainly didn't answer them. Those question marks just are glaring. So what do people do when you have question marks? You fill it in. You discuss it. Your imagination fills in all of the details, and pretty soon you know that that's all true because, well, we've got this text and it just had to be that way. Anyway, I'm reading from the book of Enoch, chapter 6. You'll recognize the story. I'll read from chapters 6, 7, and 9. They're really short chapters. They're like paragraphs. Okay. In those days, when the children of man had multiplied, it happened that there were born unto them handsome and beautiful daughters. And the angels, the children of heaven, saw them and desired them and said to one another, come, let us choose wives for ourselves from among the daughters of man and beget us children. And Shemyaz, being their leader, said unto them, I fear that perhaps you will not consent that this deed should be done, and I alone will become responsible for this great sin. They knew it was not right, okay. But they all responded to him, "Let us all swear an oath and bind everyone among us by a curse, not to abandon this suggestion, but to do the deed." And they all swore together and bound one another by the curse. And they were all together 200. And they descended into Arados, which is the summit of Hermon. Many of us have visited. Nice place to visit. And they called the mount Armon, for they swore and bound one another by a curse. Hermon with a het. Herem is an oath of destruction. It's a curse. And mountains are often holy places in popular spirituality all over the world. Deep, slow places on the river, mountain tops, big trees, big rocks have always attracted attention as places of spiritual power and or danger. So anyway, Hermon joins them. So they called it Mount Hermon, for they swore and bound one another by a heron, by a curse. And their names are as follows: Shemyaz, the leader of Arakeb, Ramael, Tamael, Ramael, Danel, Ehezkel, Barakyal, Asael, Armaros, Batarel, Ananel, Zakel, Samomasef, El, Kestarel, Turel, Yamayol, Arazyal. And these are the chiefs of tens and of all the others with them. Okay, that's the end of 6. Now to 7. And they took wives unto themselves, and everyone respectively chose one woman for himself. And they began to go into them, and they taught them magical medicine, incantations, the cutting of roots. They taught them about plants. And the women became pregnant and gave birth to great giants whose heights were 300 cubits. That's 450 feet. They did the math. These giants consumed the produce of all of the people until the people detested feeding them. So the giants turned against the people in order to eat them. And they began to sin against birds and wild beasts and reptiles and fish. And their flesh was devoured by the one by the other, and they drank blood. And then the earth brought an accusation against the oppressors.
They sinned against the wild beasts?
They ate them.
That's what it means by sinning.
I assume, because in...
This is pre-flood.
This is pre-flood, and if you remember back in chapter 1, he says, "I give you all the plants for food." Mm. He doesn't say anything about eating meat.
How do you use all the plants? All the fruit and all the
seed-bearing
grass?
Seed-bearing grasses, yes.
And the vegetables are for the animals.
And the vegetables are for the animals. Very good. Yes, the people get the wheat and the animals get the chaff. But in any case, this picture of no meat and no killing is pre-flood, which always raises the question, why was Abel raising sheep? And of course the first answer is, well, to make wool coats, of course. Maybe. And, but not to eat the sheep. Okay, maybe not to eat the sheep. But in any case, here we do have eating of flesh and drinking of blood, and it leads to murder and horrible wickedness. I'm going to skip a bunch of things and go in.
That was the final thing to make the earth cry out, right?
Yes. The earth is now crying out. And in chapter 9, Michael, Surafel and Gabriel are in the sky, and they see blood being shed on the earth and the impression. And they said, "The earth has brought the cry of their voice to the gates of heaven. Holy ones of heaven, the souls of people are putting their case before you and pleading, bring judgment before the Lord." And now I'm going to skip the long bit about judgment. The plea, "And you see what Azael has done, how he's taught all forms of oppression on the earth and revealed eternal secrets in which man has learned. Moreover, Shemyaz, to whom you've given power to rule his companions, cooperating, they went into the daughters of the people on the earth, and they lay with them, and they defiled themselves, and revealed to them every kind of sin. And the women, they gave birth to giants, to the degree that the whole earth was filled with the blood, with blood and oppression. So there is the status of things. And now the question is, how are we going to read these chapters? Because our experience, we're not afraid of angels coming in and taking our women from us. And of course, the text here doesn't say that they kidnapped the women. It says they took them, which is an idiom that means to marry. And so the one translation I read that said they married women, that was actually very good. Because to say took instead of marry in English would then imply rape.
Force.
Yeah, by force. Whereas that isn't necessarily implied in the Genesis account. Now let me just jump. Does this have any relevance? Let me jump to Jude, and I'll read you a story or a reference from the one chapter called Jude. I'm reading from verse 5. Though you already know this, I want to remind you that the Lord at one time delivered his people out of Egypt, but later destroyed those who did not believe. And the angels who did not keep their positions of authority, but abandoned their proper dwelling, these he has kept in darkness, bound with everlasting chains for judgment on the great day. In a similar way, Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding towns gave themselves up to sexual immorality and perversion. They serve as an example of those who suffer the punishment of eternal fire. And I'm going to skip on down. That phrase in verse 7, in a similar way, Sodom and Gomorrah gave themselves up to immorality and perversion. That similar way, many scholars have said that similar is referring back to the angels of verse 6, in that he's...
Of chapter 6 in Genesis?
Verse 6 of Jude.
Oh, I see, okay.
Verse 6 of Jude is chapter 6 of Genesis, which is also chapter 6 of Enoch. Wow, 666. And that the writer of Jude is thinking about the picture as filled out in the book of Enoch. And because this is talking about a sexual perversion, and the... Excuse me, I'm going to... sneeze. We'll come to that in a second also. But talking about a sexual perversion, and that is the link to Sodom and Gomorrah. with a sexual perversion. And if a person says, well, no, you can't assume he was acquainted with the book of Enoch, then you jump to...
But in general, there's a concept of angels being able to kind of... angels being a lot more frequently crossing their abode, like those verses about you should always be nice to people, because how do you know you might be treating an angel?
Unaware, yes. Now, verse 14 says, Enoch, the seventh from Adam... excuse me, I have allergy. I thought I was over it this season, but anyway... verse 14 of Enoch, see, the Lord is coming with thousands of his saints. of his holy ones. So he quotes Enoch. Now, how do we make sense of this? And let's go back all the way to Genesis 6.
Was that quote 6:14?
I'm sorry?
Was that quote 6:14 in Enoch?
No, it was chapter 6 through chapter 9 that I was reading.
Oh, the what you just then read, that you were reading out of Jude. I mean, the quote that you just did, was that 6:14?
No, it was... Let's see, where was that?
Yeah, it was. The last verse was 14. It was about all things that Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied.
That was 14 of Jude.
Yeah.
Not,
right.
There is no 6:14
okay.
In Enoch.
In Enoch?
I don't know. I'd have to go back and look it up. But it is there.
All right.
Somewhere. Just not in paragraph 6.
Okay.
The chapters of Enoch are short.
Okay.
So when you hear that Enoch has 108 chapters, that doesn't mean that it's the size of half the New Testament. It's if I could have one of those, that would be a help. It's non-contagious because it's allergy. Okay. Well, thank you. So let's come back to Genesis 6 and start asking where these stories are coming from and how we can relate to them. I can briefly say maybe that there's at least three, yea, four ways that we can relate to this story. One of them is that this is a story about angels coming down and fornicating with humans and creating monsters, and it never happened, and is just like pagan mythology, like the Greeks. And so it's in the Bible, and we just laugh about it and say, well, it's just not to be believed. So in a sense, you could say that one position is that it's referring to angels, and it's false. Another way that this has been interpreted, as we will see, is that Genesis 6 is referring to human beings, that there are no angels here, that it's just human beings. And it's true.
And when they say malachim, they mean like messengers or something.
No, there is no malachim in the Hebrew. It's
b'nei
elohim.
Of course.
Okay, so one is that it's angels and it's not true. Another view is that it's people in Genesis 6, and it is true.
Well, what kind of people? If it's sons of God.
We'll come to that too. I'm outlining the territory now so people will know what's at stake. A third position is that it's referring to angels, and it is true that, you know, this really did happen. There was a time when angels came down and fornicated with people and made monsters. Because the Bible says so. And that's a third position, that it's angels and it's true. And then I guess a fourth position would be that it's referring to angels and it's not true historically, but it is true as the Bible writers used the story. So it has a literary function, but it's not true scientifically. You don't have to go looking for Nephilim bones buried in the earth or strange DNA.
There's also another one brought that they're aliens.
Well, that's a subset of three.
Yeah, okay.
That's a subset of three that says that it's referring to angels, heavenly beings, and it's true. And
how do you explain that scientifically is aliens?
Well, we have a friend who is now trying to link up Genesis 6 to the end times. What happened in Genesis 6 before the flood is going to... No, I won't go into that. Okay. But there, you wouldn't believe how many ideas have come out of this chapter. And it makes good sense. Why would so many ideas come out of it? It's because there is so much left unsaid. So let's go back to Genesis 6 and do this slowly. When human beings began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them. Okay, daughters. Clue number one. Where are daughters mentioned?
It's the first time.
No, it isn't.
Adam had sons and daughters.
And all of the, in chapter 5, every one of the sons of Seth, at the end it says, and he had sons and he had daughters. Whereas earlier, the daughters aren't mentioned, which is why the proverbial question was always raised by people that wanted to shake a young believer. They would say, so, now that you're a believer, you're going to read the Bible. Where did Cain and Abel get their wives? Bible doesn't say. Okay, well, now we've got daughters being born. In chapter 5, after Seth is born, we have lots of daughters being mentioned. So, humans are multiplying and daughters were born to them. That's very good. And the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful. Now, the sons of God here in chapter 6 is entering out of the blue. Just out of nowhere. And that raises a lot of questions. Because they're not defined, it implies that people already know who's being spoken about. Which opens up Pandora's box, because now, you know, what are the imaginations, or what is this pre-knowledge that the writer is writing to these people about? And if you go back to the Middle East, how is this phrase, sons of God or son of God, being used? And we do have a few places in the Bible where sons of God refer to angels. Where, like in the beginning of Job, where it has the sons of God walking around in heaven. And we do have the heavenly council sons of God mentioned in Psalm 82 and Psalm 29. So this idea of sons of God referring to some kind of heavenly beings is recorded in the Bible. And we also have things like, we have some of the ancient mythology that's been discovered through the texts at Ugarit. And we have the sons of God mentioned there, which is the Canaanite pantheon of gods, of El and Baal and Anat and their Korhots. Yeah, Saba, that's right. So, if we say, who are they? The audience is probably going to know and have this kind, they're going to know something about this mythological background that is mentioned briefly and never developed in the Bible. For the Bible, it's almost a closed door, except for a few mentions, and then here we get it mentioned. But there's another meaning, sons of God. A son of God is also referred to as a king can be referred to as a son of God in the Middle East. And it can be referred to a son of God in two ways. The king, like the Pharaoh or the head of Ashur, Babylon, they can be looked upon as a son of God. And so they're the king and they're human. And then another way to look at them is that they end up being merged with God and they become divine. And so you can get these divine ancient Middle Eastern kings, which you can look at their origin and say, oh, well, they're human, but you can look at another from another direction and say, no, they're divine, or the people treated them as divine. And the people in the audience also knew about this kind of Son of God. So which one is the writer of Genesis referring to? Well, they see the daughters of humans, the daughters of Adam, were beautiful. If the sons of God are angels, then they're seeing humans, and we're getting the background that is developed by a book like Enoch. So let's take it the other way. What if the sons of God were somehow some kind of rulers? These are rulers among men, ancient pre-flood dynasties. Just who are these sons of God? And there have been three answers given. Three? Okay, one is generic, just rulers. These are dynastic rulers who were taking harems. That's one possibility, but others have specified it a little more tightly, and so they said, oh, the sons of God saw the daughters of humans, and obviously in here it's seen as bad. So the sons of God, these would be the good humans, and so we'll call them the sons of Seth, and they see the daughters of humans, or they're being enticed into sin, so we're going to make the daughters of Cain and Cain's descendants, and read the text this way. And that so-called Seth interpretation was popular in the ancient church, and it turns up here and there. And it can even be reversed, because if you look at the context, where do the daughters come from? The daughters in chapter 5 are from the descendants of Adam. So maybe the daughters are the good daughters, they're the descendants of Adam, and the sons of God, these are the sons of Cain, and they're the instigators and the bad people. And there is something actually good about the story in Genesis for seeing the sons of God somehow as human. And what is that? What could justify reading this paragraph as human rather than angels? What could justify reading this paragraph in chapter 6 that the author intended the interpretation to end up as human?
The 120 years?
The 120 years? Yes, that's part of that direction. The judgment in chapter 6 of Genesis is not against angels. It's against people. Now,
so you could say that the daughters of men is clearly human.
The daughters of men are clearly human, but the flood story is a judgment on human, and this verse 3, that their years are going to be 120, and verse 5, you see how great wickedness of the human race had become on the earth. The judgment all through here falls on people. Now, an answer to that saying, the flood has all the animals destroyed because of the sins of the people, so why not have the people destroyed because of the sins of the angels? Logically, you could still argue that case is coming about, but one of the problems of reading this text as being used to refer to angels is that there's no judgment of angels mentioned anywhere in the text. Now, there is a mention of a judgment of angels. They got it right in Enoch. So in Enoch, and in Jude, well, Jude's referring back to Enoch. In Enoch, I didn't read it to you, but a little bit later, the angels are judged and they're bound up and they're thrown into darkness, which is what Jude quotes when he refers to Enoch. He says those angels were bound and put into darkness to suffer the eternal fire.
Well, no, it says about angels to wait for judgment.
Angels to wait for judgment?
Yeah,
but they were bound.
Yeah,
right, they're bound.
They're bound
waiting for judgment. And then Sodom and Gomorrah, the example of eternal fire.
Ah, Sodom and Gomorrah is eternal fire. But who gets the darkness? The
angels are in darkness.
Yes, the angels are in darkness. So, in Jude, there's a reference to the punishment of the angels. And in Enoch, there is a reference to the punishment of the angels. But in Genesis, there is no punishment.
That's the eternal chains under
yes.
gloomy darkness.
Under gloomy darkness. That's Jude. And that's quoting from Enoch. It's later. I didn't read from that. It's something later in the book. But
Enoch clearly takes it as angels.
Enoch clearly takes it as angels, and Enoch then fills in the question, like, so if they're the ones that instigated everything, then where is their judgment? And so he answers the problem of righteousness by writing the book of Enoch and says, well, they got theirs. They sinned, and they got judged.
And also Jubilees.
And Jubilees, yes, that picks it up. Jubilees is
but
normally considered later.
They answer why the women are judged who, in this account, really have no say in the matter.
In this account, they have no say. They're victims.
Yeah, so why would they be judged? Why does all the earth become bad?
You mean why does Genesis, or which one are you?
Yeah, why does Genesis, in verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth?
Well, because this would be a development from that wickedness developed out of that. So, if the sons of God and the daughters of men are talking about two groups of people, one of which has forsaken a good or a godly walk with God, they are now going to be raising up generations of evildoers. To the point where they flood the earth with evildoers, and the Lord is able to find Noah from among them. The point here, though, is that in 1 through 4, there's no judgment of angels, which leads me, I've written on the board here, people and angels, and I've got 4 points of reference. Angels, people, angels, people. And if you first read Genesis 6 and you say, what's the most likely reading of the sons of God and the Nephilim? Nephilim means fallen ones. I think the most probable first reading is angels. But as I read the text in Genesis, and if you look at the history of interpretation of Genesis, you can go back to Jewish commentators and you can follow that up through Christian commentators up into the 20th century. There has been a long string of people that have interpreted Genesis 6, 1 through 4 as a kind of exaggerated description of human rulers and human misconduct. And so if these were originally stories that had pagan myths behind them, then what you might have in Genesis is a telling of that story in such a way that it becomes amenable. It fits in with a human interpretation, and so you now have it humanized in Genesis 6, where the angels are mentioned because everybody knows these stories, but none of that is developed. He simply leaves it undefined, ambiguous, within a story of judgment on humans. But, and this would be early, this is when Genesis is written. I think Genesis was written during the First Temple, early First Temple, even back around David's day. So now it's just fit in as a big question within a human predicament. But then at the end of the Second Temple, we have expanded the angel motif again. And now we have a book like Enoch describing angels, and we have a translation of the Septuagint. And the Septuagint, when it gets to verse 4 and it talks about the Nephilim, the fallen ones, the Septuagint puts in the word giants. And you have to know, now a giant in English might just be a metaphor for a big person. You know, he's a giant. You know, he plays basketball. He's a real giant. But in Greek, giants means the giants. Where do they come from in Greek mythology? Kronos, the father of Zeus, rebelled against his father, whose name was Sky or Uranus, Uranus. And he went up and attacked his father, castrated him. Blood fell on the earth. And
it was blood.
What?
It was more than blood. It was just blood.
Well, it was the blood that fell on the earth. Well, it was the parts. He threw everything down there. But it was blood and the father's parts that fell on the earth. And from that grew up the giants.
Yes.
This is Greek mythology. So when the Septuagint takes a word like gigas, giant, and it translates Nephilim with gigas, that lets you know what the Septuagint translators are thinking here, reading here. So they're reading this as monsters, as angels coming down, fornicating with human women and creating monsters. And they're borrowing then the Greek term gigas. And Josephus says almost the same thing. Let me, still got a few minutes, 2 or 3 minutes. Let me try to read. Let's see, Josephus. I can get to it quickly. I'm going to read from Antiquities, Book 1, verse 72. The posterity of Seth continued to esteem God as the Lord of the universe, to have an entire regard to virtue for 7 generations. But in the process of time, they were perverted and forsook the practices of their forefathers, and did neither pay those honors to God which were appointed them, nor had any concern to do justice towards men. But for what degree of zeal they had formerly shown for virtue, they now showed by their actions a double degree of wickedness, whereby they made God to be their enemy. This is the posterity of Seth. So right here, we're hearing people, but listen to the next verse. These are the posterity of Seth being corrupted. They made God to be their enemy. For many angels of God accompanied with women and begat sons that proved unjust and despisers of all that were good on account of the confidence they had in their own strength. For the tradition is that these men did what resembled the acts of those whom the Greeks call giants.
It's like he combined the two.
Josephus is combining the two and
humans are bad.
And saying that they're doing things that are like the giants, which is interesting. The Septuagint doesn't say like the giants, the Septuagint just says they're giants.
That's your third dot.
Yes, my third dot down here, this would be Septuagint, this would be Book of Enoch, and Josephus seems somewhere in the middle.
Did Josephus punish the angels? Does he record punishment that God laid out upon the angels?
Let me go to the next verse. But Noah was very uneasy at what they did, and being displeased, persuaded them to change their dispositions. Yes.
I knew Noah was
getting... No. Josephus does not record the punishment of the angels. So Josephus is not using the Book of Enoch. He apparently is mixing what I would call a Hebrew and a Septuagint reading. He knows the Septuagint, he's writing in Greek, but he is taking this as a kind of human, a human interpretation, the line of Seth, the godly line being corrupted, like giants, like the Septuagint translates. Anyway, who else takes it as angels? Of course, Jude. We just read Jude. So we have Jude using it as an example of punishment. Now, remember, Jude says you need to remember that the angels get punished. It is possible to read that. It's possible to read that, meaning that this is an example of punishment. It's an example of justice. And to say that it doesn't teach anything about the scientific nature of how angels and people would commingle. It's simply saying that angels, you know, you're going to get punished. Angels got punished in Enoch. Sodomites got punished. Other people get punished. You're going to get punished if you do evil. And then, which brings us back to a, call it a Josephian interpretation, where you can take a rational reading of Genesis 6, saying it's toying with angels, but in fact it's dealing with people. And as I just mentioned with Jude, you can leave the question of did this happen? You know, is it really true that there were angels that fornicated with people that produced giants called Nephilim? You can leave that question out and say that actually it isn't part of the biblical canon. The biblical canon doesn't say that that's false. And in the book of Jude, it does use it as one example of why you know that God does punish. He punishes sin. Nevertheless, the Bible is silent on this whole kind of question of these angels, what they did, exactly what their offspring were. When you get to the book of Numbers and we have the Nephilim there, those Nephilim are...
Is it Gigas?
It is Gigas in Greek, of course. But and the book of Enoch says they're 450 feet tall. And the book of Numbers says we're like grasshoppers before them. But you can take that as literary hyperbole. So... are we required to read? Did the writer of Genesis fix our reading to be giants and angels cohabitating, crossing boundaries? I didn't mention other ones. The planets are supposed to all have, stars and planets all have angels, and the angels that left their position, some have also referred to the planets because the planets move around and leave their position. And that was another ancient interpretation, that the angels that sinned are the angels of these planets that don't stay fixed like the other things. But that isn't what Jude, although that interpretation is there, that isn't what Jude was referring to, I think, because the next verse says immorality.
You know, Jude does talk about stars.
It does. Does it talk about stars there? I don't remember, but it does link their sin to the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah, which to me means it's referring to this episode of angels. So where do I actually stand? To the story of Genesis 6 to me is a story filled with questions. We don't get to know who the Nephilim are. We don't really get to know who the sons of God are. This little paragraph does become a literary foil for the wickedness of people with the flood. What is clear in Genesis is that people are going to be judged in the flood. And
Jude 12, these are blemishes on your left knees as they feast with you without fear, looking after themselves, waterless clouds, swept along by winds, fruitless trees in late autumn, twice dead, uprooted, wild waves of the sea casting up the foam of an unchained, wandering stars for whom the gloom of utter darkness has been reserved forever. So you could argue it's scary, but...
Yes, that would be included. Anyway, what we have in Genesis is a... In this paragraph is a precursor to the judgment of humans, for men are flesh. And the writer of Genesis has taken this paragraph and fitted into a story that is dealing with judgment on human beings. So whether the writer of Genesis is thinking of angels, or whether he's thinking of reinterpreting the angels, is not clear. Why he put the paragraph in there, would I have been happier without it? Yes, I would have. I would rather not think about this paragraph. Yet, in the ancient world, people did think about this, and our author put it in there, and drags us into a whole world view that I think most people throughout the history of the world have been uncomfortable with. And that's why the distinct interpretation of sons of God being the Sethites or the Canaanites, and the daughters of men either being the Canaanites or the Sethites, became popular. In either case, it's talking about some kind of corruption that took place where we're coming down from the pre-diluvian godly realm into a world where men are going to be judged. And that's what we can take out of chapter 6 and what its actual history was and what the author of the book of Genesis thought he was writing. I'm not sure. And because remember also in terms of time, Enoch, the book of Enoch is being written 1,000 years after this book of Genesis. We cannot assume that the book of Genesis has the same picture as the book of Enoch. The book of Enoch has the judgment of angels. The book of Genesis doesn't. And so it leaves us in this very strange predicament of having a window into all sorts of really bizarre ideas and question marks, and it just leaves us there. And I'm sorry I have to leave us there, but hopefully we will be able to follow the Lord even with a window into this bizarre world of this bizarre world view that was in antiquity. And let us know that God is just. He loves us. He takes care of us. Will provide for us. And if there's angels after us, He will protect us from them. Although that doesn't seem to be the big concern throughout most of the history of the human race. With that, I say Shabbat Shalom.
The Jews.
Yes.